Gets Personal. I'm Eric Anderson.
I'm Rusty Gaffney.
And I'm Jay Thelman.
And today we have Joey Kleinhans, who is a certified sommelier and owner of the Wine Elite, which he'll tell us more about. But first word from our sponsor who makes this show possible. And that's the Wine Club. With over 20 years in operation, three stores in California, and an online presence, the Wine Club is one of the largest wine and spirit merchants on the West Coast. Their stores are located in San Francisco, Santa Clara, bordering San Jose, and Orange County. Although their name might suggest otherwise, they're not actually a club. No membership is required to shop with them. Just come on in. They're known for having friendly, knowledgeable staff, an amazing selection of wine and spirits, and ridiculously low prices. Their wine experts lead tastings every week in each of the three stores. You may find them online at www.thewineclub.com. All righty, we're back. Rusty, why don't you introduce today's guest?
Well, I had heard about some wine education events that Joey has conducted here in Orange County. And I was quite impressed by his background and his resume. So today I thought we would sit down and talk about wine clubs in general. I know I personally have benefited from belonging to a wine club for years. It's how I really gained my wine knowledge. And talk more about wine educating and entertaining with wine. Joey, let's begin with a little bit of background about yourself. Give us a little brief introduction to you.
Sure, and thank you for having me on the show. My background is somewhat interesting in that I don't have a long-term career in wine in my history. I moved here from Germany 10 years ago, so I'm a U.S. citizen now, and worked for many years in the investment management industry. So I worked in Frankfurt, London, New York, and spent the last couple of years here in Orange County working in the investment management industry for a large bond trading company. And I retired from that position and from that industry earlier this year after a couple of years of being so fascinated with wine that it basically carried me deeper into a hobby than I ever imagined. And so I took the certifications of the Court of Master Sommeliers and the Society of Wine Educators and started a wine club that now has a following of a couple thousand people in Southern California. So that certainly gave us a lot of provocative thoughts on wine.
What is a sommelier?
A sommelier in the traditional sense is a French restaurant professional who knows the wines inside out and advises and serves guests in a fine dining environment, tableside. That is the closer sense of a sommelier. But in general and in the United States, anyone who has deeply studied wine and perhaps works as a wine educator or as a speaker on wine, and who takes an independent view on wine appreciation, not representing a certain type of winery or wine style or marketing scheme, would be considered a sommelier. So it's basically a wine expert or wine professional and at least a wine student.
And is formal education or certification part of being able to use that title?
It is not. Everyone can call themselves a sommelier, and there are many sommeliers working in the United States that proclaim themselves to be basically the wine director of the restaurant and thereby the sommelier. But there are exactly three organizations in the United States that have a reputable wine education program that makes you deserve to hold the title sommelier after a couple of years of study.
Is it important to have certification, do you think, Joey? Well, obviously you must because you've got a certification.
I learned so much in the study program with the Society of Wine Educators to become a certified specialist of wine, that is the CSW designation, that I feel without formal study of the theory, so which usually means you learn the regions and which grapes belong to these regions, and then you taste them. Without that formal program, I think restaurant service alone or practice and talking casually about wine doesn't give you the full picture. So I'm a big proponent of formal education in the field because wine, just like any other topic, has essentials to learn about the field. And that requires reading and studying to become really good.
There's levels of this, aren't there?
The Court of Master Sommeliers has four levels. The Society of Wine Educators has two levels. And the third organization, the Wine and Spirits Educational Trust, also has four levels. And they're all competing with each other. Some educate or make wine educators. Others make floor sommeliers. And another organization create something in the middle. So it is a range between theoretical wine educator and restaurant client-serving practitioner. And it's often a philosophical question which program you would like to go through.
So you veered toward the educational aspect.
In practice, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think I will become a restaurant sommelier anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But I took both exams to be skilled in both parts, and both aspects are a challenge. I had never worked in a restaurant before I was 33 years old, and I found it very challenging to properly, with the right etiquette, the right demeanor, and all the right moves, serve a fine dinner party. So it's quite a roller coaster. I recommend it to anyone, even if you don't have a background from that field.
Do I have that right then? You felt that you couldn't serve the clientele well unless you had been formally educated then in the process.
Yes, I definitely needed that touch. It didn't come natural to me. I had to practice it.
I understand the book knowledge aspect, name all the wine regions, AVAs, whatever. But how important is inherent physical talent a part of that equation?
I get that question a lot. And I have found out that the talent is not the dominating factor. Very often, we receive the questions in our club meetings when new members join. They would say, oh, I'm overwhelmed by the commentary I hear from at the table. I don't have a palate like that. I don't have the talent. In fact, I don't feel very confident when I'm smelling or tasting things. And my response to that would always be that the practice of getting to know the essential wines of the world, in best case in a blind tasting format where you can completely abandon the idea of I have to speak to a certain label, I have to recognize a certain grape, that really makes your education. So actually you can start from zero at any age and within a year become a very proficient, knowledgeable wine taster if you don't try to understand all the exotic sideshow grapes that don't really play a role. The essentials of wine are very easy. There are only two dimensions. There are some top wine regions in the world. There are some important grapes in the world. And then there is a marriage between specific grapes that simply grow best in certain regions. There may be, on the red wine side, only 10 to 20 essential grape region combinations. You can learn those very quickly, and you will make an enormous jump in your wine knowledge without talent.
I'd like to push back on something you just said. You said, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are certain areas or regions that grapes grow best in. But isn't that a subjective judgment?
Let me qualify best, and that takes the subjectivity out of it. If we talk about taste and preference, yes, it remains a question of the individual preferences. But when you define the idea of wine typicity, which is from what region does a specific grape show a very characteristic identity, which you can recognize over and over again. If you study the great wines of Italy, Barolo, based on usually 100% Nebbiolo, you taste a couple of these wines and for the rest of your life, you will likely not miss them. If you have a wine of that region that always can replicate that flavor experience for you. So that helps you to learn. If you would get involved with wines that are growing in a different area, let's say you become experimental and you drink a Nebbiolo from the United States, you will have a very hard time recognizing it as a Nebbiolo. So we're using the trick of typicity, showing a clear nature of a certain type of wine by pushing out the flavor preference, and that is a more difficult topic to discuss, I agree with you.
Is there such a thing then as varietal correctness?
I think so. But correctness is a harsh term. Correctness, from my perspective, would be the view of the educator. How do you enable someone who starts from zero to understand a specific grape or region? How do you get them there fastest? And to answer that, I would point them to the traditional and classical regions that make these wines in a certain style. You're confusing everyone if you show them a nice new flavor or an exotic interpretation of a wine. You may have a nice new data point, but you're not learning systematically. I'm interested in learning systematically, keeping knowledge that you can keep for the rest of your life.
So this is sort of like world history, essentially. We're going to the origins of these grapes where they grew well for centuries,
mm-hmm.
and that's the benchmark that we hold.
It is a benchmark in terms of what you can expect in the future. So if you're learning systematically, you're looking for patterns. You're looking to discover principles rather than experimentation. And that usually leads you back to the old world. France, right, above everything, probably in terms of the ability to recognize a certain wine in a certain region. And then, of course, Italy, Spain, and the white wines of Germany. If you study those first, you're building a very solid fundament so that later on in your studies, you can handle the winemaker's interpretation of a Napa wine or the innovative wines of South America or generally the Southern Hemisphere, which can be mostly a vision of a winemaker rather than adhering to specific traditions. I think you understand the experimental work much better if you have that solid, reliable, traditional set of knowledge.
Jay's right, though. I think there is the feeling of subjectivity that can come into this. To use Pinot Noir as an example, which has just gone leaps and bounds in a very quick period of time in California, if you want to contrast that with Burgundy, and if I understand correctly, you're saying it's better to start out with Burgundies and then go ahead and experiment with other things. I was curious about a term you used to refer to other areas, newer areas, predominantly New World areas. You used the term exotic. I don't disagree with it necessarily, but mm-hmm. how did you arrive at that word to describe those mm-hmm. New World wines?
The term exotic I only use in terms of flavor profile. I taste 1,000 wines per year. I taste them all blind. I'm doing nothing but profiling and pattern building in my wine tasting. So I try to recognize certain wines. That's the whole challenge. So exotic for me is any wine that doesn't fit into one of the classical flavor profiles. And maybe we can just talk about Pinot Noir because it is a beautiful example of bringing the world into the essentials. So Pinot Noir traditionally...
Well, Pinot Noir, really? Do we have to talk about Pinot Noir, Rusty? For God's sake. Every show we do turns to Pinot Noir. Okay, I'm sorry I interrupted you, Joey. Go right ahead.
Let me say something that may be novel then if you had a lot of Pinot Noir discussions. So I want to make the case that the original Pinot Noirs come from Burgundy, the soft style of raspberry, cherry, and strawberry with earthiness and a little bit of oak. Sometimes hard to access. That is the Eastern French Burgundy style. Everything else is just a derivative. So here come the acceptable derivatives if you are a wine student and want to understand the grape. Acceptable on the world map may be Oregon and New Zealand. And then there is a long gap because in California, we have our own more meaty, more dark, more fruity and more alcoholic interpretation of Pinot Noir. These can be fantastic, bombastic wines, but they're hard to study because we're using aspects of enhanced flavor, richness in alcohol that is not in the base interpretation. So I would say for Pinot Noir, there's truly just a handful of appellations where you want to start your studies to understand any type of wine.
You know, hearing those descriptors and the way you described it, at least the way I personally relate to wine is, I like to remove that superfluous stuff that sometimes surrounds a wine and get down to its essence. Do you think that going through and, let's say, call it analyzing a wine, thinking about the wine, can sometimes detract from the just sheer experience of the wine? You know, enjoyment, let's call it.
I would think there are the two types of enjoyment. The classical old world enjoyment is the food pairing attribute. What is the proper food pairing? Where the wine and the food don't overwhelm each other one way or another, but where they complement each other with flavors that create a third experience. You notice the food, you notice the wine, and then a third experience, which is the combination thereof. That is the old world's idea of enjoyment. In the new world, we often have the visual that we're longing for a wine that you enjoy by itself front of a fireplace, perhaps with a cigar, that is flavorful, that already stands on its own. And of course, that is the end game of wine enjoyment. And what we often do in the field of wine education or studying wine, we become obsessive with something where we saw initial enjoyment, and now we want to learn more about it. We want to spend time in understanding it. But I fully agree, we must always come back to the original enjoyment of the fluid. And my recommendation is to do that without knowledge of what you're drinking when you can, by blind tasting, if you have the opportunity. We very often have a situation where I pour a wine and say, how would you like to enjoy this beautiful 95-point rated Napa Cabernet Sauvignon? And I always, if I give people that information, I always get a good review on it. The person says, oh, it's fantastic, thank you very much. So I didn't really give them any space to make up their own mind. The best experience we have is, here's a glass of wine. I won't tell you what it is. Are you liking it? What are you enjoying about it? And that really propels the full unfolding of a person's preferences, where they cannot be punished for developing an opinion that goes either way. Not every wine is enjoyable.
Yeah, you know, the American consumer, particularly a California consumer, I think they start out with California as their standard, rather than going back to Pinot Noir or even Chardonnay. California is their standard, and because that's the wine that they're most likely to start out drinking, just because of its availability, its presence on wine lists, its affordability. So rather than start out with Burgundy, they most likely start out with California. And you'll find that a lot of people that develop an interest in wine advance to Burgundy or to France or to Germany only after they've started out with California wine.
And I'd even take it farther, Rusty, at least maybe in my experience, tasters usually start, or drinkers started with Cabernet.
Right.
You know, or maybe Syrah, you know, and then they moved on to other things. So I don't know if that's still the case, but.
So I'm just wondering, what are your comments about that?
My experience from the U.S. market is that we drink a lot of wine that is available and that is pushed by marketing. And for sure, that is mostly California Cabernet Sauvignon. And that is a very agreeable wine. Anyone who gets serious over the lifetime with wine will converge to the old world. I've not seen an exception to that. So we have a lot of collectors who come to us in our tastings and say, I've tasted wine for 30 years and I really enjoy that I always have a very different experience. I'm always looking for a new wine and flavor. And when we then later talk a little more, they confess that they really haven't learned anything systematically over wine. That is not true for everyone, of course, but there is a theme that in America we believe the wine drinking process is for the sake of diversity. And that is not helping you to get the full experience out of wine tasting. The real pleasure comes out of using the knowledge that you have gathered over the years. You recognize principles of certain flavor types that you enjoy and that you can classify, and then you see certain twists applied to it. So you taste a Brunello that has a little bit more dust and ashes than another Brunello, but you learn to categorize the important wines of the world. If you want to do that, you have to go back to the basics where there is some coherence in the styles. In California, our virtues are, again, let's make a wine that's different. Let's integrate new concepts, because we have the freedom in the United States to not be bound by appellation laws that dictate certain flavors. In Italy and France, government inspectors come to the wineries and only apply the AOC stamp if a wine tastes typical. And that, to a degree, helps the beginning wine student. They can understand these profiles. But of course, it doesn't allow for the creativity of a winemaker. The answer to the idea of American wine preferences is, I think you will even enjoy yourself more if you open your eyes to the whole world of wine. And of course, the center of that is still Europe.
The organization that you founded, the Wine Elite, its purpose is what?
The purpose is the systematic appreciation of the wines of the world, usually in a sommelier-guided fashion, where the sommelier takes a consumer's role and ruthlessly, together with the tasting group, comments on the quality and the nature of the wines at hand, where we don't have to follow anyone's selling agenda, but where we learn without pretense about what we actually can pick up in these wines, and learning systematically so that by the next session, people actually have so much knowledge that they can contribute to a discussion that is richer than just random anecdotes of wine appreciation.
The name itself, the Wine Elite, how did you arrive at the name of the organization?
It was a word play. The idea was to show the elite of the wines from around the world. It doesn't reflect on the members.
Okay.
You mentioned about blind tasting, so I assume that's the format you use.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, would you agree that while blind tasting has a lot of advantages, it can be mitigated by how it's performed?
Yeah. So we developed, after many trials and errors of hundreds of tastings, a couple of formats that always work and that unify different skill levels. The one challenge that you have in a wine club, you have some very experienced members who come from a perspective where they believe there are few things that they can be taught, where they would like to get involved in showing others their knowledge. Others are joining who would like to be interested or like to be involved with wine and wine connoisseurs, but they don't have the knowledge or the experience. Blind tasting brings everyone on the same page. Even the most advanced drinker, if you put a set of four different red wines in front of them and tell them which wines are on the table, but not which order it is, it gets everyone in the same perspective and creates a very friendly atmosphere. The trick that we use in blind tasting is we always have several wines next to each other. That means we're not tasting an individual wine, because people have a very hard time describing a glass of wine on an absolute basis. They feel much more comfortable pointing out contrasts between several or among several different wines. And that's where they feel they can come out of their shell and articulate, this wine seems to have much more alcohol than the other, and this one has a browning rim, this one not so much. So the contrast is how we get the conversation starting, and that's where the success of the tastings comes from.
Yeah, I've seen sometimes the group psyche can affect people. You say it's great. You say something like that, that's going to have an impact on me. Well, this guy knows what he's talking about. How can I say it sucks?
Yeah, we have a trick for that in place. I usually have a couple of other sommeliers with me in the tasting. So I have a vast network of sommeliers who use these groups as a forum for advancing their wine knowledge. One of the sommeliers is designated to establish the secret order of the wines on hand. All the other sommeliers have to be involved in the blind tasting, and that is sometimes highly embarrassing. So I usually prefer to be blind tasted, since I lead these tastings and the discussion for 10 to 30 people. All of us have 2-3 glasses of wine in front of them, and we have a general idea as a group what we have in front of them, but the order is unclear. So I take the lead in trying to blind taste these wines and tell everyone up front how difficult it is and that I will very likely get it wrong. I try to not get it wrong, but in around 50% of the cases, I don't get it right. And that is a relief for everyone at the table, because if you speak about flavor components, and I would say, well, this wine here on the left really has a soft layer of roses and a pretty harsh tannic wall towards the end of the palate and pretty alcoholic, it's barely opening up. This appears to be something like a Barbaresco from Italy. It has this Italian meaty truffle passion to it. In the end, it comes out, it is nothing like an Italian wine, and basically everyone around the table is relieved that I get it wrong. And I don't mind getting it wrong, because you learn so much by doing that. So in the second round, everyone is willing to not necessarily point out which wine we're drinking, but they would like to offer a couple of descriptions that usually use more intuitive terms that are often more helpful than any technical language.
What do they know about the wines in front of them?
It differs. Sometimes we're doing a blind tasting around the world where they only know we are showing the great wines of each country. And we give hints like, of course, Rioja is the most important Spanish wine. There will be a French Bordeaux. There will be an Italian Brunello. There will be an American Napa Cab. So we generally give them a sense for the wine types that are on the table, but we never reveal the order. We're trying to establish the order together by the principle of deductive tasting and exclusion. We very often don't make the statement, I believe this wine is the Carmenere from Chile. We make the statement, this wine is so fruity and purple in the glass, this certainly shouldn't be the Burgundy Pinot Noir. The color profile doesn't make sense. The flavor profile doesn't make sense. It's exclusion that brings us to the solution more often than not.
Yeah, that style would appeal to me more than putting yourself out there and saying, okay, I think this is a Brunello and it turns out to be a California cab. And that would be more appealing to me.
You said 10 to 30 people, Joey, at one of the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And take me through a typical session. Let's say I'm interested in this. You have members. I imagine I would join. Is there a fee for that?
No.
So take me through a typical meeting. I show up one time, mm-hmm. sign up for it.
The background is usually that we have alliances with restaurants and hotel that provide us their space, and we can work with their wines, or we can bring in some wines some at times, and they don't charge a corkage fee. So that is the initial arrangement, because a tasting group must be financially viable. We want to taste high-quality wines, because you learn best from mid-range and some high-end wines. So we need to make sure that as a group, we have some pricing advantage and some cost advantage so that we can have enough members who want to stay engaged. We very often do this in the framework of a multi-course dinner. We take 2-3 hours. There is dinner served. It's often optional, and that is served by the host venue. And then for every single course, maybe we have 3-4 courses, we serve 3 wines right next to each other. So everyone has 3 glasses in front of them, and those glasses for every single course will be refilled. And so we go round by round and try to describe and assess in terms of quality very openly these wines and why they are nice or harsh and how they compare in quality and in perceived value. So we go through several rounds, which is really helpful. In the beginning, people have to get used to the style of let's try to exclude mm-hmm. certain suspects, as we just described, mm-hmm. that exclusion is more powerful in a wine tasting than actually calling a specific wine. And as the rounds proceed, people get much more interested in being opinionated. And that's, of course, what we want. We want our members to build actual skill without the comfort of knowing what the label tells you.
Draw them out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Rusty, that sounds similar to the tastings I remember you used to do with your club. I've been to some of the dinners you used to go to. It sounds very similar.
Yeah. You know, I was in a wine club for years, and we didn't always taste blind, because sometimes it was tasting a vertical or horizontal mm-hmm. of a particular wine, and so there wasn't any sense to do it blind. But we certainly did blind tastings enough that it was valuable, and we certainly learned from that. And then to pair it with food, of course, is very important, because wine is food, and you want to learn to enjoy it with food. I mean, you can enjoy a lot of wines by themselves, but probably in the dining situation, you often enjoy the wine even more.
So using Eric's example, so he's paying for basically the meal, whatever wines are there. He'll know in advance what that's going to be, right? I mean, it's kind of all preset.
Yeah, the price will be known, and so that should always be all-inclusive. We make a deal with the restaurant or hotel to accommodate us. And what you often don't know is which wines will be served. Sometimes we advertise it if we have something really interesting there, like a 100-point scored wine or some legendary vintage where we have a couple of wines from that year. But in most cases, we let you know about the topic. For example, the great wines of Tuscany, where we then study in detail the classic appellations, Chianti, Chianti Classico, Brunello, some super Tuscans. Or another theme, for example, Merlots from around the world, where we simply study how Merlots can show in different countries and try to bring out the character of the country by the different Merlot interpretation they use. So there are no limits to that. The topic is always known to you, and you have to have a good sense of adventure to sign up for that, because you want to go into that tasting with a certain sense of mystery. If you know too much, then it would be mechanical. You're not learning anything, and that's where it makes more sense to go to a retail store to taste through their tastings, and you know exactly what you're doing. But if you're doing this for learning and for an extreme social experience where you're having a good time with people who are very interested and sometimes obsessed with wine and can share their knowledge, mm-hmm. that's where you want this hint of mystery over the tasting, because when you have your tasting sheet in front of you and your pen and you have a set of hints and these wines in front of you and some sommeliers share textbook knowledge where you can say, well, he says, Syrah should always be more purple than ruby. So I would think this wine in front of me fits that color description and it also smells like black pepper. So it's nearly like a puzzle or a little mystery where you have some hints at hand, but you become very competitive with yourself. You're really highly determined to get this right if you have enough hints that you can work with. And that's where the fun is.
Yeah, I get from you that a central theme is to take a disciplined approach. Would that be a fair statement?
You have to walk right on the edge. You have to give people enough information so that they can work with it, but always be a little bit out of their comfort zone. Part of that is, yes, you make the topic of the tasting very clear. You're operating in a delimited field where no one feels like, he could now show us certain wines that I've never heard of, and in that case, I will not be able to contribute anything. So yes, you need to provide a good amount of information and have a very systematic approach for it so that people are actually enjoying it.
Well, that's what I was referring to, this systematic way. I mean, discipline, a lot of times, you know, I've been to a tasting where you don't see everyone looking right at the color and maybe the rim and, you know, really thinking about it. It's more about, did I really enjoy it? What did I get some heat immediately or something like that? Not really, first I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, and discipline. You know?
Yeah. Right. I think it's pretty playful. It evolves over the evening. So in a first round of a blind tasting, everyone is puzzled sitting there with three red wines in front of them. And I would then just point to one of my special guests, usually someone who's comfortable with blind tasting. And I would ask them, tell me, we know that somewhere here tonight, we're looking for a Chianti Classico that is 5 years old from one of the traditional makers. What should we look for in this tasting? And then he would describe, yeah, well, the classical flavor profile would be sour cherry and think a little bit about tomato sauce and an Italian meatiness. If you detect that, you may be close to a Chianti. So people will automatically then pursue these three glasses and try to find out, could there be a Chianti on the table? Do I recognize anything that I just heard from the sommelier? And those must be very intuitive terms. Otherwise, they are not helpful. So you have to provide, as you go, helpful information that bring everyone on the same page.
Do the people that come to your organization frequently have a very wide range of previous experience with wine? Are some complete newbies and others have been, you know, consuming wine for, you know, decades, that kind of thing?
It is the full range. And sometimes I wish we would have a more cohesive group of people. I theoretically think about that. But in practice, the refreshing part is always to integrate a whole group that comes from different levels. And we have people with a very vast collection who specialize in certain wines and others who say, I really don't know anything about wine. And I was a little nervous when I signed up for this tasting. And my job is 2 hours later to have them all in a spot where they had an excellent evening and all added to their existing knowledge. And the best weapon that I know for that is the blind tasting, because I have not seen anyone who can consistently prevail in a group of 10 classical wines of the world and get them all right. I have not seen it. You hear about it, that there are many skilled individuals who are just very good at it, but it remains so difficult that the most qualified person in the tasting becomes very humble and bonds much more with those who are not really privy of the technical terminology or of the map of the wine world yet. So this unifying approach is actually the most satisfying part of these tastings.
Yeah, we used to say in tennis, if you want to get better in your game, you had to play somebody that was better than you on a pretty consistent basis, because playing people that were not better than you wasn't going to do anything for your game. I wondered if that transferred to this experience, but it sounds like it doesn't, because of the blindness, because of the fact that, again, they're sort of humbled. It's sort of, I can see where a bunch of blind wines in front of you would bring somebody who was quite experienced almost to their knees trying to guess what some of these things were.
You know, we have to be honest. It's not all fun in these tastings. I think some people get stressed in such a tasting because they feel so much pressure to know something or to compete. So We hear very often a typical issue in tastings or in the wine industry that consumers are intimidated by some who believe they have more knowledge, and they make judgments like, oh, how can you mistake this wine? And have you never had this type of wine? And then they drop a bunch of names. So name dropping is a big problem where people deal a lot with positioning. They are very competitive. If you know a little bit about of wine, you want to show it, and you want to show others that you are better. That happens very often. So there is, of course, and you all know that, the stigma of snobbiness and hostility sometimes in tastings. And the way I do it has the one goal to remove that. So I must be very careful if someone is tasting and isn't very experienced and takes a strong opinion and says, well, I think this is a Merlot. I really like Merlot. Then I have to be careful if it's very apparently not a Merlot from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I have to be careful to choose my words. You can never say, very clearly, this is not what you believe it is.
You don't say, you dummy. No, that's not
so,
a Merlot.
So you're suggesting that egos can easily be bruised.
Yeah, very fast. It is actually
the
biggest hazard in wine tasting is the self-image of people and how their wine knowledge reflects on how they think about themselves and about others. And there are a lot of psychological issues attached. So the trick is always you go back to listening to how they described the wine rather than making an outright guess that it's basically a winning or losing proposition for their ego. When they say, this is a California Zinfandel, I've been collecting them for 30 years, I know what it is. That's very difficult to say. So I would not directly comment on that. I would simply go back and say, share your flavor impressions with us. Are you, when you speak about Zinfandel, are you picking up the marmalade, the high alcohol and the viscous stewiness in that and some of the lighter fruits? And he would say, well, yeah, I'm seeing the following things. And I would then simply go back and say, well, if you look at a textbook approach, how you describe the wine, you actually did describe a Zinfandel, perhaps another thicker wine. So it's very interesting to make sure everyone walks out of that tasting happily.
So the wines are in front of the guests. Is everyone just taking notes and then speaking, or are they, as they taste it, they're just free form? How does that work?
You have to be disciplined. Wine tasting is so much about the psychology of the people in the room that it's scary. It can dominate a wine tasting. So here's how you address it. If you let someone speak about a wine and say, would you please take the first stab at describing the wine? Everyone else at the table, if they haven't made up their mind in writing, everyone at the table will be so much influenced by the first speaker if he speaks with conviction.
Yes.
If you introduce a person like, oh, a long-term collector, please identify your thoughts on this wine. And then he says, you know, it's clearly a left bank Bordeaux. Everyone around the table will then say, I agree with him. It seems like a left bank Bordeaux. So they are so highly influenced that you can't allow for that. You have to have everyone first commit their own thoughts to paper. And then we have a shared, always voluntary commentary on the wines. No one has to say anything, but some people would like to share what they say. And it's so easy to be manipulated by someone else's idea. You have to completely isolate that.
I agree completely.
No question.
My experience in a wine club of 20 people was that the first person to say something influenced everything that came beyond that. And even though we knew each other and been together for years, some would not want to talk against someone else
who was
seen as more knowledgeable.
And totally. I mean, just tasting with you guys, even though you guys are the most open, easy to drink with guys, but if you say something about a wine, especially if it's Pinot, how can I not be influenced by that? It's just not, I mean, I think it's sometimes more subtle than that. It would be a world of difference, for example, if I heard you say, I think I smell beets versus there's beets here. Just that subtle, that mm-hmm. difference can have a huge impact.
It's group dynamics. So a lot of times, and I would agree 100%, when somebody starts off, it's almost as though they're hijacking the group think. And as they start off and they put their stamp on what this is and what you're supposed to think, they don't know they're doing that, I don't think. Well, sometimes they probably mm-hmm. do, but they'll do that, and then everyone else will start to think that way. But you'll also find that there'll be some challengers to this. If everyone doesn't knuckle under, this person that led off with the "I know what this is" kind of thing will end up falling, and they won't step out again. They won't do it again. They won't.
That's
they
true.
Won't lead with their nose or their chin one more time after that.
What about the selection of wines? There's so many variables. Good vintage, bad vintage, relatively speaking, how old the wine is. How do you try to keep everything on a level playing field?
Yeah, you define the topic of the specific event. So topics can be certain regions, can be essentials of the world where, again, you cover the key grapes that people want to learn about in a essential knowledge approach. And frankly, you never get done doing that. You can do every week a tasting where you simply show 10 different red grapes from 10 different regions and you never finish, right? So this, even for the advanced wine taster, every single time, since an individual wine can be an outlier sometimes, which we never hope for, but can be confusing. But you always delimit the topic very clearly. Perhaps you have a topic of aged wines in comparison, aged European classics, where you show something like a 1980s Bordeaux versus an 80s Rioja versus an 80s Barolo and a Chardonnay du Pape. So you try to have a flat playing field in terms of the comparison you make. However, since we have a lot of interaction in these tastings where some of the sommeliers usually give hints or say, based on theoretical knowledge, or let's imagine this would be a very typical set of wines. Just by looking at them, you can tell the more browning wines are usually the old ones. So it would be really nice to see wines with extreme color, because even if the age has not been announced in the blind tasting, you can actually then establish this wine has the profile of an aged wine, or this looks more concentrated. So you gain ground on these open questions throughout the tasting, and you share the knowledge that is on the table.
You do both New World and Old World, correct?
Yeah.
And how do you source these wines, Joey?
We have partnerships with several retailers. So, of course, we work with many restaurants and hotels and see what they have. But mostly, if I put a flight together, we go to one of the large, diversified retail stores here in the Southern California area.
What's the average cost of an event?
Yeah, usually with a dinner, $120 gives us enough playroom to allocate half to the food and half to the wine. So I'm a firm believer in high-quality wines, and that is a whole discussion that is controversial. Are expensive wines worth it? I believe yes. We see a lot of people who say, I've been tasting wines for 30 years, I feel I haven't learned anything. And I tried that once 10 years ago. I also felt if I could just discover all the value gems at around $10 to $20, I will outsmart the market. But frankly, you will have so many distracting, unimpressive, blended wines in the cheaper field. You learn very few things. The better the wine, and unfortunately, in general, not always, in general, the higher the price, the higher the quality of the wine. And what does quality do? It may taste better, but what it usually does is giving you a clearer view of the identity of the wine. A high quality wine gives you 5, 6 different descriptors. It reveals its nature so more clearly than a cheap wine that it's much easier to blind taste expensive wines, much easier. And that's usually what we tend to do. Mid-range and expensive wines.
Now, it's become pretty popular for people to entertain at home and have wine events at home, wine parties. And I'd like you to comment about how do you organize a wine party at home, and what would you do if you wanted to have friends over, and how would you go about it?
Yeah, so the first question is, does the host have wine knowledge a little bit? Because you need someone who facilitates. You can actually put excellent wines in front of a group of people and they will not have a good time. They will all say, oh, this is nice, and they qualify the wines a little bit, but very soon the conversation will move to other topics because there is no structure in it. So if the host is wine knowledgeable, it can make total sense to get 2 glasses for every guest and get some cheeses, go shopping at one of the retail stores and buy some known mid-range wines from around the world, that are very different in style, right? So you can start with a couple of white wines. I would always go for certain extremes to show contrast. You don't want to show similarity. That's just confusing. You want to show the citric acidity of a Sauvignon Blanc, perhaps right next to a German Riesling with kerosene and oiliness and sweetness on it. Because many people, especially guests who are not wine aficionados, who are just coming to a party, they have not been clear about that there is a whole world of white wines that can actually be interesting in contrast. In America, we drink a lot of Chardonnay from America, a lot of Sauvignon Blanc from the United States. That is not the range of comparison that is really exciting. You want to show off Sauvignon Blanc versus Riesling versus Viognier versus an Albarino. And these contrasts are very revealing. They often open the wine hobby to people who never had the chance to actually get into it. The problem is always, will you take the gamble of trying something new that you're completely uncomfortable with? Or would you buy something you know you like it, or you know the recipient of that gift that you're buying will like it? Wine clubs fill, and wine parties fill, this niche because there you can be experimental. It is a shared cost approach. If you would like to drink a very expensive bottle of wine, you don't necessarily want to buy it for yourself and the guests. But a wine party where you have 10 people, perhaps a shared cost, not always, but there you can actually experiment with a larger array of wines. And for a home party, the route that I would take is definitely the diversity in the world of wines, different countries, different grapes, and then perhaps tasting them two at a time, talking about them briefly, and then coming back to the social interaction of the group. But every 20 minutes or so, we're tasting another wine. Who would like to lead this discussion, which the host usually does? And what many people do, they hire a sommelier or a speaker who can handle events and can be entertaining and nice. And that becomes a great party.
So you see the contrast in what you're pouring for people as being the most important factor there then?
That is what people find interesting.
Okay.
No one is excited about a tasting by just being in awe about the qualifications of other people. People want to relate the experience to their own self-image, to their own experience. So contrast gives tasters the idea, I can tell the difference. I learned something. I saw this very clearly. What these people just described wasn't just another stew of technical terms that I didn't get because they seem to be so far above my head. You want to be able to relate, and contrast allows for that.
Well, the thing is, a lot of people want to bring a wine to the event.
Right.
So they're going to a party. Everybody wants to bring a wine. So that makes it more complicated. There you have to more generalize the theme.
I actually tried that format of allowing people to bring wines that are their choice, and it's usually not a good solution. So if you would like people to bring their own wines, you allocate a wine to them. If you have a certain topic in mind, you would ask them what we would need would be a South African wine. We would like to taste a Pinotage because in the United States, you bet, unless you have people who are already very interested in wine and have a collection, you bet most of them will bring a medium or low-priced American wine from the supermarket, and that doesn't make a good tasting. It destroys the tasting. So you need to have some guidance in there to have a really cool event.
Yeah, can't say I've not seen that happen. Talking about contrast, it just brought back a memory for me where the host poured the same wine, but in one case it was directly out of the bottle, and then that same wine that had been decanted for 4 or 5 hours. And that to me was an epiphany when I saw that difference. And I could tell the contrast. I might not have had the words to describe the difference, but I could taste it. I could experience it. So I can relate to what you're saying.
You can use all types of little tricks that you tell everyone about. So we very often would have a set of 8 different wines from a certain region, and they would all be known to have good quality. So I would announce perhaps that all of the wines tonight have been rated 92 or higher. Except one. That wine I bought for $4. It is the same grape than all the other wines. And your only job tonight is to find that cheap wine that is not highly rated, that is worth a fraction of the other wines. And I will give to any of you who picks that wine, a bottle of Barolo. And I usually tend to keep my Barolos.
You brought up the, I was just going to ask you about scores. I mean, and now, does this come up in your tastings? Or do you, how much do you talk about scores? And particularly collectors invariably bring up a score of a wine or want to talk about scores. What do you do about that?
We have the luxury to verify right there what ratings are all about. So very often we blind taste, and perhaps I would know which wine we're tasting, and if people are eager to talk about it, I would ask, the rating of this wine is known. I won't tell it to you yet. How do you feel about this wine? Is this very high quality? So from your experience, since you're a collector, would you rate this perhaps a 95, or is it less spectacular? Is the wine a disappointment? And we would go around the table and hear voluntary statements on the standard of this wine. Is it impressive? Does it deserve a high score? And then afterwards, I simply share the score with them that it has been allocated. And usually, right, the wine advocate, the wine spectator allocates scores. Sometimes they are aligned. Sometimes they are in contradiction. But if the critics say one thing and then the table says the same thing, it doesn't need further commentary. They can make up their own mind. Very often, we have a very large disparity between the impressions of the tasting group and the ratings. So very often we cannot identify with the ratings. And the question is then always, are we dealing with bottle variation? Are we tasting a bottle that is certainly not representing what the tasting publication has seen? Or is it just true that tasting and professional scoring of wines remains highly subjective and is just a noise factor rather than something we should actually believe in?
Well, with 30 people, you're not opening one bottle. It's, what, three bottles or something like that? So
in a large group, of course, we have several people. And more often than not, if you're drinking an aged wine and you have three tables and each of them got one bottle, you have three different sets of commentary because aged wines really develop different lives in these bottles. And that makes it very difficult. Only a very few regions are consistent over time in aged bottles.
I agree. I think that if I were you, I would much prefer that people disagreed with the score than agreed with the score, because that would tend to validate their feelings that higher number means better wine. And I think it's a trap, I believe, to fall into. You stop then paying attention yourself to the wines, and you start paying attention to the score, because somehow you've aligned one or two wines with your palate and their score, and then it validated your palate. So, wow, I'm good. All I have to do is watch everything that shows up 95 and buy it. I think it's a trap to fall into.
I agree with you. I think also kind of related to that, you have to be careful about this whole, what's the wine of the evening? What's best wine in this flight?
Yeah.
That's kind of like scores in a way. And
That's human nature. That's America.
It is.
I don't know.
We always want the competition. We want to know what's the best.
I'm going to exclude myself. I really don't care. All I care about is whether I like the wine or not. I don't need to kind of compare them. Yeah. But yes, it comes up, certainly.
Yeah. It's unavoidable. I mean, there's just no way to do it anymore. It may be if you were drinking wine back in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't going to be an issue back then. Well, maybe you followed broadband or something. I don't know. Mm. But it's funny how that works, though. But I think when you sort of arrive and you've gone through this process, in some cases, someone can taste wine for 30 years and think they've arrived at that, but you continually learn. It's a continually educational experience, tasting wine. Pinotage, you name Pinotage. I can't name the number of people that enjoy Pinotage on one hand. I like it for what it is. If you examine it, you look at it in its own little box, it makes plenty of sense. But if you want to compare it to the thrill or the pleasure someone else is getting drinking it versus drinking a Bordeaux or a Napa Cab or something like that, it's going to blow the doors off it.
South African Pinotage is an interesting phenomenon for students of wine. So if you like it or not, it is remarkable to taste a wine that gives you notes like metal and burnt rubber and rusty nails. And if you like it or not, it is beautiful to spot one.
Yummy.
And overall, see, the trick in wine clubs is to foster independence. Wine is an intellectual pursuit. It has very much to do with how people look at themselves. Would they like to follow some sort of guru who has said A and B is true, and then either say it is true or it is not true? But you don't need to take a side. You should in every single moment be critical to what you hear, because most of the information you hear through marketing and through a self-declared expert is wrong. You hear a lot of noise information that is not helpful, that is not building your skills. So the attitude that I would like to see in anyone who tastes wine is, don't believe a thing of what you hear. Verify everything. If some sommelier says, I truly see truffle, mushroom, and wet forest floor in this Loire Cabernet Franc, taste the wine, see if you pick it up. If you don't pick it up, then make sure you don't build an association where you then, in an approach of making yourself look better, use these terms and say, oh, clearly the Loire mustiness shows in this wine. So you can not do a better job for yourself than building independence rather than, okay, I'm so glad to sit with all these experts. I'm picking up all these important words. That's not what it's about. The idea is often that you are at one level and then there is a whole level, a whole type of person that is different from you and you would like to be them, but there is a huge hurdle to overcome. It's really not rocket science. You're equipped with a good sense for tastes and flavors, and the intuitive descriptions are the most valuable. If someone says, oh yeah, sure, Barolo, tar and roses. And if you taste and smell that wine and you're not picking up the red floral notes or the dirt black tarriness, you should really question this assertion. Are they just speaking from a textbook and try to create some authority for themselves? Or can you validate that? If you can validate it, you are the winner because you are carrying that into the future. And this independence, if ratings are right or wrong, I would never take a view on that. I'm interested in picking out statements that I can verify and ruthlessly declaring some information that I hear as perhaps it has marketing incentivation, right? Right. You walk into an American winery and say, show me your best wine. And they say, frankly, all our wines are great. Mm. And then you taste them and they have clear differences in quality. Sure. Some of them have very clear flaws that are objective. They are not subject to opinion. And you can have that battle forever. But independence is really the greatness you can take out of being a member of a wine club.
We always have to keep in mind that people have agendas, whether it's ego validation or a monetary reward, there's validation. So you said there was, I'm sorry, how many members do you have now?
Yeah, I tend to lose track. We have tasting groups in Los Angeles, San Diego, and Orange County. So I think overall 2,400 people I have on the list.
That's a lot.
And
so how many events in a typical month?
Yeah, 3-4 events, but not all of these members are active and many are scared off by the price tag, right? So what you see a lot in American culture is the hunting for deals. The idea of, is there perhaps a tasting where you can experience 6 wines at a bar for $20 and you have an implicit 50% discount, so you have savings? I'm not interested in any of that. I think if you're sufficiently interested or obsessed with wine, then it is worthwhile treating it like a fun seminar, like a educational social event where you actually study a field and the enjoyment comes out of that. It is not the standing around in a loud bar enjoying some generic Central Coast wines and you're not learning anything. You may enjoy the evening, but it's not really about wine then. It's about alcohol. So I would think that certain standards I'd like to keep. I'd like to encourage people more to explore more expensive wines because a whole new world opens when you receive more clarity in a wine that is well structured. And I get a lot of comments from people, you know, I want to drink wine every day, so I'm buying a $10 bottle from the supermarket. Try just 2 weeks. Instead of drinking one bottle every day for $10, just skip 2 days and on the third day, drink a $30 bottle. And you're already in a whole different field where you can pick up things you have not seen before.
Or do both.
Do both.
Get the $10, yeah. Drink the $10 bottle every day and get a $30 bottle every 3 days.
So if people wanted to get involved with the Wine Elite, what do they do? Is there a website or how
yeah,
does it
work? Yeah, they would just go to the website. Of course, there are no member costs or that. For the Wine Elite has been my playground to learn about wine and suck other people into the passion of wine. And the website is www.wineelite.org. So that's wineelite.org. And contact me from there. On the website, you can see the events that are posted in the area and different topics. And some topics are advanced tastings, and you will see that. Some can be very expensive when we taste Screaming Eagle or some of the 1982 classical Bordeaux, and it attracts a certain demographics, right? You will have people who are very serious, and at other times it's more social. I would like to learn socially about wine so that it can be useful in my professional life and I feel more enabled. So there's a whole range, and I have not come to the end of the field of possible sessions that can be interesting to people. So with a new vintage, there are always new opportunities that are coming to learn about wine.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us, Joey. That was fabulous.
Well, thanks for having me.
Be sure to go out and follow us on Twitter. Check us out on Facebook, and have a great day.